the big book is so full of so many different wonderful things that I don't know anything about. I practice all the time, but when my emotions get ahead of that God that's inside of me, bad things happen. Situations get out of control. My emotions dictate so many things. My emotions deal with sight, smell, touch, and emotion. But, and love, that kind of emotion. And I'm going to talk about a person that had incredible influence on my life. I have not talked about this person very much in the rooms of alcoholics, because it's more than it's just painful. In the big book it says, we will not regret the past, regret it, nor choose to close the door on it. And when I first came in and did my first step, it was just such a painful experience, because these memories became just a flood in on me. And I didn't know how to handle that kind of emotion. Not just that emotion, but the series of emotions that went on. Guilt, shame, fear. You know, I was fortunate to have a sponsor very early on. I asked my sponsor, gee, what do? He goes, well, he said a lot of things, but the one I picked up on was that there's no fear of guilt. That there's just no fear of guilt. In the rooms of alcohol, you know, you can't run a program with fear and guilt. So he says, cross it out. And I go, well, that, you know, that doesn't seem, that seems completely unreasonable to me. I mean, that's how I ran my life. So I did go to my dictionary and cross out fear and guilt, and that did absolutely no good. But it started to do good. The person I want to talk about is my grandfather. My grandfather had a huge influence on me. His name is Alan Crockett. He is my mother's dad. He was born in Nova Scotia, Canada. He's French-Canadian. And I remember very early on, I was always curious about where he came from and who he was. And it's amazing. This is not in the big book, but this is just my own opinion, sociological as it may be. Alcoholics attract other alcoholics. My experience. I mean, it's just natural. It's just something inside. So my grandfather was born, and his dad was the superintendent of Halifax school system. This is in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And my grandfather went to the third grade, as far as his education went. He went to the third grade. God, that is incredible to me. It's incredible because his father was the superintendent of schools. So that just kind of clued me in on what kind of person that is. I thought that was romantic when I first heard it. Well, he learned self-sufficiency, independence. The first time my grandfather, I felt the kind of love that I could understand and absorb. My parents had gone to Japan, and they'd gone to Japan for some trip. I really don't remember. But it was 1972. I was 12 years old, and I went over to my grandfather's, and he goes, what book are you reading? I go, I'm reading a book on history about Winston Churchill. And he says, man, that was an alcoholic. That was the kind of alcoholic that could work. It was a functioning alcoholic. He goes, I could teach you how to be one. And it was just that straightforward. And I thought, okay, all right. That appealed to me, because prior to that, I don't want to get into the old deal. Prior to that, I was going into the cabinets. My father was a pharmaceutical salesman. I had the drugs. I had everything I possibly needed. And I would dip into it, but not to the point of beyond recognition. But I was getting there. So my grandfather had Lejeune brandy. And Lejeune brandy was bought in cases, and it was a gallon. It was a gallon a bottle, literal gallon. And he bought them four bottles too. So He taught me how to drink that day. We did some shots. But then he showed me how to make a brandy, the kind of brandy he liked. And you just put about 3 ounces, a 3-second pour, and a little water, a little splash, and you have it. But that was just, that didn't seem odd to me. And he told me how to get buzzed. And he told me how far the buzz should go. And he said it in his way, which is a kind of a French-Canadian way. But he said you don't want to fill the cup too full, and you don't want to get too buzzed. You just want to be able to maintain, to recognize, but have the freedom within that recognition to say what you want. So you want to be filtered, but not unfiltered. So it's that kind of go-between. You know that, oh man, that buzz right before the big one comes? That part right there? Well, he stayed in there. But I did all the driving for him. And so he would have me drive him around as I got older. You know, got my license and got my permit. And we would go to these bars that he went to. And the biggest bar in Fresno at that time, I need to digress. He had a brother. His name is Sandy. Uncle Sandy is in a book called The King of California. He sold out to Boswell in about 1961 for all his land for $16 million. And then my grandfather went and had a car dealership. He started selling furniture in Hanford, but you know, he started working department stores in Nova Scotia. And then moved to Hanford because my uncle was in Dinuba, my great uncle. He started a department store, but then he got his car dealership, and it just progressed and progressed, where he owned his own car dealership. He owned a section of land. And I'm telling you this not because this is all about ego. It is sincerely about ego. It is not about spirituality. It's about the emotion that's attached to ego for me. That's why I learned from my grandfather how to be emotional and egotistical at the same time. So he had the possessions. He had a West Side property, 864 acres. He had with my uncle a manufacturing plant in L.A. that did with the Apollo 13. I mean, we're talking, you know, power. And I didn't, as a young kid, I didn't recognize this. I just knew Grandpa ran air conditioning at his house, and at my house, there was none. You know, that's how my father, very Spartanistic. So I'm starting to take around my grandfather to these bars, and the biggest one that had the biggest appearance was this one called Pardelli's. And he knew the owner. And you go in there, and I just remember just being hit by this. I went in there and I found the halls of power. These guys were buying each other drinks. And the waiters were dressed up white, black cummerbunds, very formal. And my grandfather bought a round for the house. Now, all of these were his friends. They were his friends. And we're talking the owner of Patrick James. We're talking Al Ratto. We're talking all the big players. And they were by. And I literally thought that my ego was based on how many stacks of drinks would be behind my grandfather's. And it would just come and it would just go. The halls of power is a very heady thing. Power. Power. And you hear these guys talk. And they're talking these big deals. Now, my own particular house was not about, it had a ranch. It was a completely different atmosphere. But to be in that, I just thought, man, this guy loves me. He really loves me. In chapter 3, we just read, with or without a solemn oath, the things that I was promised, the things that, if I played my cards right, I could probably have. So I then, right then and there, determined that I would be what my grandfather was, that I would carry on that type of heritage. Well, as the years go by and I get into my 20s, my grandfather and I are still very close. He lost, my grandmother died, and he came over to our house, and that's just a mess. My mother, alcoholic. My father, tremendous, tremendous workaholic. And so I would go down and buy an EJ brandy on sale and come back. And it got so bad, my grandfather went to my Uncle Bill's, and I drove him. Of course, I was the one that was driving him. And he was drunk, and he talked about my grandmother in a very, you know, not a good way. It wasn't a happy marriage, so I picked up. They never talked to each other, but that happened at my house, so I thought that was pretty good, normal. And so he talked about all the different women he had had through his business associates. And I go back to that broke my heart. I decided to distance myself from him. And we got drunk that night. And I took him over to Oxnard to my Uncle Bill's. And he got drunk that night. And as the years go by and things happen, my grandfather knew that I didn't think much of them anymore. And he's walking out, and he is an alcoholic. He considered himself a functioning alcoholic. So he thought of my grandmother, and it broke his heart, and he didn't know where he was. He had so much pain up inside of him. He didn't know where he was. And he lost control of himself, and some things happened there, and then he fell, and he died. And one of the greatest regrets I have is not being sober. And we will not regret the past, nor choose to close the door on it. In the fifth chapter, it says, we beg of you. Beg of you. And so, I had a person in here with 4 days. And you know, that word beg, I looked it up. It's a position where there is great urgency and passion. It's a petition. Because, you see, when I understood how to take an oath, and when you swear to something, it's obviously someone to hire. But just the mere fact that you're taking an oath is kind of a serious thing. And my grandfather, I felt, didn't love me because I rejected him. And little did I know that his habit of going out on my grandmother and having all these dalliances and things like that spoke to my mother. See, I never put these things together when I'm an alcoholic, when I'm drinking with my grandfather a lot, or I'm taking pills from my father's great stash, or I'm stealing from my mother, drinking her stash, doing all those sort of things that sound romantic, that sound clever. Gosh, but then it came that sentence, we beg of you, beg. And I never understood that word spiritually. Never got it. But I imagine I was in the middle of just staying sober, of not drinking. And I felt like there was like a red carpet of mercy. When they use the word we, it's a group of people begging me to be fearless and thorough. Well, I did not know any emotion. I mean, I knew a lot of different emotions under the influence, but being fearful was one of my best ones. Being fearful motivated me to try to do something with my life that was bigger than the one I saw my other brothers and sisters have. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result is nil. When I first came in here, I did not have an understanding of what alcoholism is. I had an understanding of what the book said, but I didn't have an understanding like it's a spiritual and it's emotional and it's physical and you have a craving and it's a phenomenon, but it's not just a craving, it's a phenomenon, a craving. And I didn't know where to go with all that sort of stuff. I read Harry Thiebaud, and this really spoke to me. Harry Thiebaud is one of the people. And he wrote about alcoholism in a way that's so much different than I had ever read before. And he said, there's three basic types of ego. Because in the big book, it says that alcoholism centers in the mind. It centers. It's its location. It is in the mind. Boy, that struck me as odd. So Harry Thiebaud wrote, look, there's three basic egos. There's the id, which is a small ego. It's what, you know, babies start out with. Gosh, they're just happy. Da, da, da. But then there's the id and there's the ego. That's the normal ego. And then there's the superego. And I think you know what that's about. The superego told me I could do things that I wasn't qualified to do, and if I just learned how to fake it well enough, if I just learned the right words to say at the right time, at the right place, gosh, that's qualities of omniscience. I am not God. I thought I was. The superego tells me. And Harry Thiebaud says, if you miss superego with the rebellious nature of an alcoholic, you have alcoholism. And it centers in the mind. That started to make sense to me. That made sense to me in a real way. Oh my gosh. Getting drunk on the ranch. Having Picker show me how to get drunk on the ranch. I could do work. I could work very, very hard. And work well. But I never realized that I was feeding my superego in order to make me feel something that I didn't think was possible. And that's valued. It says in We Agnostics, it says this wonderful thing that all of us know that God is there. But see, what I wanted from my family, what I wanted from people that I wanted to get close to, I wanted their love. Now, I don't want to, you know, the Bible talks all about that, the three different types. But there's the agape, which is that I want the paros, the individual love, the kind of love that is just for me, about me. That's not being self-centered, the big book talks about. That's being spiritual. That's a step two. Gosh almighty, I just didn't have that. I was 55 when I came in. I did not have any of that. I didn't have anything. I mean, went to dinner, Rick was telling me that, you know, I was 325 pounds. He goes, yeah, you were gray and yellow. And your hair was falling out. And, you know, you know. I mean, really? Okay. That's great. That's great. I feel that Alcoholics Anonymous and the past that I bring to this, it's an amazing thing to feel valued and not be unique. That's an amazing phenomenon to me, and I only got that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only got the sense that there was a value, there was a power greater than myself. You could call it God, you could call it whatever you want. You can name it whatever you want, but it is undeniable that this higher power has given me things that I possibly could never obtain through approval, through achievement, through my superego. There is nothing I could have done. There is no strategy, no book. I have done them. I have been in the mental institutions. I have done the self-improvement as being the most expensive one I had done. Warner Earhart, you know, you pay $600, sit for 3 days without taking a piss in a room, and they tell you at the end of that, this is it. Well, that is incredible, isn't it? This is it. Wow. That was, well, man, I had to take my father's credit card and, you know, get drunk. It's incredible. What I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is more valuable. What I found is people that have similar... See, I always really feel... I go, everyone's talking about... You know, my sponsor is talking about the higher power is an individual thing. Everyone has a different one. Well, I just don't see it that way. I think all of us have a higher power that have two things in common. The first one being that we're here. The second one being that He loves us. He loves me, and He loves you. And if you're 5 days in, 4 days in, whatever, an hour in, you just got off, whatever it is, that's the second step. The first step was the hardest step for me. And I'll tell you why it was the hardest step for me, because I had an ego coming into the first step. And so what I did, it's the last line in the first step prayer says, remove from me all denial of my alcoholism. Remove from me. And the first step being, of course, we admit it. But in the prayer it says, remove from me all denial of my alcoholism. Now, it says all. That's every part of me. And it says in the big book that we have to admit to our innermost self. Now look, I don't know where God is. I have no idea where He's located. I mean, I've been to church, did all this sort of stuff, and they always look down, and I thought, God, that's the location of hell. But it's not the location. Where God is, and where I found in AA, and I was startled by this. It's in here. It's right in here. When I started to refuse my own denial, God, the emotion and superego, the emotion and ego, the emotion and the regretting the past, the emotion and thinking of the past and achieving something within the past, it doesn't matter. For me, what mattered to me is that I begin to admit the powerlessness, the denial of that powerlessness. Everyone describes powerlessness as in a different way. For me, it's emptiness. It's a void that cannot be filled. But and then they say, well, it's a surrender. I never looked at it as a surrender. But what I looked at is finally having the opportunity to have the weight taken off of my shoulders and the understanding that there is a step two right after step one, because I'm getting sober not to get sober, but I'm getting sober for the fact that I don't want to carry resentments around. And resentments, they say in the book, big book, is the number one killer. I don't know what up until that point, I was 55 when I came in. I didn't know what a happy life was. I knew how to struggle and eke out some achievements and get to the fact that I did not have the type of achievement I wanted to have. But when I hit step two, and I come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to this incredible word, and this is a spiritual state. It's called sanity. And it says, again, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. You know what happens after that? The result is nil. Until we let go, absolutely. Oh my God, step two, to be able to let go inside here, where my emotions shrink down and my spirit gets bigger. You know, the spirituality, isn't that a great term? It's spirituality. Spirituality means to me is trying to make a connection without understanding how to make a connection, but knowing that the connection is real because I'm doing things differently. That was the first time that I began to understand not to blame my mother for her alcoholism and abuse. Not to blame. I blamed her, but not attach blame to it. I can say that hurt me to my higher power. And it can end there. And then I have options. One, get away. Two, pray for them. I like one. It's much more satisfying. But two, to pray for them. See, if I don't believe that a power can restore me to sanity, if I don't have that willingness, but not only... See, the willingness to me is more like that begging. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough. Beg of you. And my sponsor asked me to be sober. He wanted me to be sober. God, he was on my side to be sober. And there was a few other people early on that were on my side. I felt that we were on my side. I never had that kind of support. Not the person, you know, not the qualifications of the person saying it, but the emotional support that it takes to grow spiritually. And so when I started to understand that I didn't have to hear my father calling me stupid, or my mother calling me fat, and my mother asking me to borrow money when she makes more money, when I didn't have to feel like I could get back at her and maybe she would change her ways if I got back at her, when I started to understand that sanity wasn't about vengeance or my ability to think of an angle that no one else has thought of, when I started to understand that I could give myself a compliment and God would agree with it, my sponsor, you know, he's a son of a bitch, but I love him. He told me, he says, you know, Ron, you ought to look in the mirror and tell you, you know, that you love yourself. And I go, you know, I don't argue with him. I just listen. So I tried it, and I wasn't able to do it for a couple. I look at myself, and I wasn't able to do it. But then I realized in the second step, the same thing to do to put my ego in check is be able to treat myself with the kind of dignity and respect I saw people treat my grandpa with, but without the haze of booze, without the money, without anything. Because when I got sober, I was $40,000 in debt, living in Summerfield's apartments. My ex-wife was going to divorce me, and I'm sure she was going to take all of my money. All of our money, but you know how that works. My daughter wasn't going to talk to me. And the funny thing is, I wasn't giving myself compliments during those times. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to ask for love. Not the, you know, the intimate kind. And I gotta take a little break here and just interject my own observance of being in the rooms. And what I had to do with my mother and putting her in a place of honor. My mother was a lady. My grandfather didn't look at my mother. My grandfather in the 70s, they would come over and dress up my mother in these $10,000 dresses. So they told me that she was a homecoming queen for USC in 1946. When I was a football player, Frank Gifford, but she never felt. She came in for a year, left. She never felt like a lady. She never felt like a lady. I'm looking at a lot of ladies out here. And I beg of you. I'm sure some of you have done. But you're ladies. You're just ladies. And that step number two began to unfold inside me the innate value you already have. You just have it. And men, besides being assholes, you're gentlemen. You're a gentleman, and you know how to treat yourself, and God will teach you. I'm sure he will. If you already don't know, some of you already know, but you're a gentleman, and gentlemen treat ladies a certain way, and ladies treat gentlemen a certain way, and I have seen that happen in the rooms of AA. My mother never received that. My mother never got that. I never looked at my mother as a beautiful woman, but she was pretty. I guess homecoming queen, and she always kept that crown. And she didn't know she already had it inside. Step number two. Man, the great thing about step number two is I made a list of how I wanted to feel when I was done praying. I wanted to feel like I was being listened to, but more importantly, I wanted to feel an emotion that I had never had and wanted to understand it. Now, these emotions don't charge the ego. I've always noticed that. My emotions, like empathy, like thinking of someone else, that does not charge my ego. But what I have found in practicing this over and over again, I have found that those shutting the door on a past is not necessary, because my mother, my father, my grandfather, those are those who took a solemn oath to raise me, to protect me and love me. They didn't do it. Those are those who tried to do it and didn't. It's absolutely okay, because this is the incredible thing empathy did for me. I know they did their best. Are you kidding me? I know they did their best. And I know they're in a place right now. It's a funny thing. I have really bad dreams about my mother and all those sort of things. And it just happens year after year. And it seems that when I fail, that especially accentuates it. And I feel like she's going through 12 steps and she's still on her first. But I started to do something different, because I think prayer is a great avenue. And there's this prayer of St. Francis. In the beginning, it goes, "Lord, make me a channel of thy peace." And this is the line: "I don't know how to accomplish it. Where there is hatred, may I bring love." What? Where there is hatred. Hatred is my God. Who doesn't love to hate someone? Right? But in establishing a step two, that prayer began to open up to me. And my sponsor is really, I mean, I can't say enough good things about him. He told me that you should let God be God. And that was, you know, I mean, that's a great phrase, isn't it? But he says, pray for someone like this. Let them have a good day. God, let them have a good day. And that's it. See, it's my ego thinking that I could do a Genesis to Revelations and point out where I think they need to have a good day at. Because, my God, aren't we? I mean, I'm good at pointing out character defects. But in step number two, I learned the difference between a character defect and an error. Because I know my experience. When I put effort in this program, there is error. There is no effort without error. Hi.
Hi. 5 minute warning. 5 minute warning.
Yeah, I got that with the fingers. But I appreciate that. Step number three. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. My sponsor says, turn it over, turn it over, turn it over. What I found in that one, is how to practice the steps of AA on a daily basis. Someone in the meeting said, Tommy said, you know, you could take God with you everywhere. And I didn't even know I could do that. To be able to take God with me everywhere is a question of practice. But it's not the kind of practice. This is a book of action. But it's not the kind of practice that, you know, you see all the time, that I see. But what I do is that I remember, chapter 5 is a great chapter, that we're dealing with alcohol. It's cunning. That's with me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's baffling. It's confusing. Cutting it knows every angle that you have been through and more. Baffling. It's confusing. But the most dangerous part of that phrase is it's powerful. Able to kill. Able to maim. Able to distort. Able to cause dysfunction at such a level that you think that's normal. I do. Not you, me. I think it's normal. Man, to be able to turn that over that mess, that conglomerate of pure crap, to turn it over and to be able to get results differently than I ever thought possible. Spirituality before materialism, I love it. Because now I know how to treat myself in a way that is sound. And by extension, I can treat you that way. I think it's valuable and honorable to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you so much for listening.
Guys, can we give it up again for...